The Great Lakes' frigid fresh water used to keep shipwrecks so well preserved that divers could see dishes in the cupboards. Downed planes that spent decades underwater were left so pristine they could practically fly again when archaeologists finally discovered them. What you need to understand is every shipwreck is covered with quagga mussels in the lower Great Lakes. Wisconsin State Maritime archaeologist Tamara Thompson said also, everything, if you drain the lakes, you'll get a bowl of quagga mussels. Archaeologists aren't the only ones concerned about the state of the Great Lakes. Mercury, plastics, and other contaminants and fluctuating water levels create headaches for fishermen, shippers, and communities whose drinking water comes from the lakes. How successful are efforts to conserve or restore the lakes? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Jim Hurley, director of the UW Aquatic Sciences Center, which houses the Sea Grant Institute and the Water Resources Institute. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me, Norman.
Well, it's a lot to ask somebody to cover the entire Great Lakes, which vary so much from Lake Erie all the way up to Lake Superior with different geologies and, I assume, different problems, too, in terms of their relationship with humans. But how far back do we have data with which we can even compare how we stand today?
I guess the main source or the richest data set probably comes from starting in the early 70s up until now. And when we think about looking back at that time 50-plus years ago, it was about the time that the EPA was established. It was about the time NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, as that was being formed. That's probably when the richest set of data that we have on the lakes came for issues like contaminants or nutrient inputs and such. And as a response to issues that really led to the establishment of the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, the environmental movement of the early 70s that really forced that issue, established those agencies, and specifically for the Great Lakes, there was an office established within the Great Lakes that just focused on the Great Lakes area. There's a rich amount of information that comes from that. But there's also been research at our universities that predates that we might be able to pull together on certain types of issues. But I'd say it is the richest data set and much that has led to the success of remediation or cleanup of some contaminants in the Great Lakes. Probably that set goes back to about the time of the establishment of the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and also there was a Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that followed that too. So it's not just the U.S., it's Canada together with the U.S. And even more so over the last 15 years or so, more of a rich database. And you just think about all of the changes that have occurred since that time, our ability to do remote sensing, sensors within the lake, different ways of getting data that we didn't have before. It's really an exciting time to be studying the Great Lakes because of the new technologies that we can use to observe change.
It's easy to assume that the years leading up to the 70s, maybe from, I don't know, as early as 1900 up until those Clean Air, Clean Water Acts were passed, it's easy to assume that they were in a miserable enough state that these acts had to be passed.
True. I mean, if you go back to probably one of the key events that really heightened the environmental movement, it was when the Cuyahoga River was burning.
Sad but true.
If you go back that far, well, you know, here we are some 50 to 60 years later, and the Cuyahoga River is being restored for fisheries. It's a draw for Cleveland. There, the flats area that's a tourist destination is along the Cuyahoga River, and it still serves industry too. And there are many examples of that, of similar types of remediation and cleanup around the Great Lakes.
those acts then required industry to clean up its act enough to make such a radical difference in a place like the Cuyahoga River?
Yeah, it came at a time when there was regulation that discharges from what we call point source pollution. Those were the main issues that were addressed during the early part of the Clean Water Act. And by point source, it would be a pipe or a discharge or a smokestack if we're talking about clean air. And the first thing that we had to do, or the two countries of Canada and the U.S. had to do, was put in systems that could treat wastewater, or so that there weren't as many direct discharges into the lake. And then after that point, then you can get into sediment remediation, taking dirty sediments or contaminated sediments out of the rivers, like the Fox River here in Wisconsin, and then cleaning that whole, the term is area of concern. Cuyahoga River was an area of concern. That all came out of the Clean Water Act to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement with Canada, that these areas of concern around the Great Lakes were identified as priority spots to clean up, to remediate the sediments, to make sure that we weren't adding additional contaminants to those. And we're starting to see some success stories that way.
Speaking of sediments, I seem to recall there was a time about maybe in the 70s or later when it was suggested that Lake Erie was actually aging rapidly in terms of getting more and more shallow. What's the status of that if we're talking about sediment?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Lake Erie is that back in the 70s, we had problems with point source pollution, that there were discharges from wastewater treatment that wasn't really treating to remove the nutrients, the phosphorus, the nitrogen and such. And that led to excessive algal growth. That algae would then die and start to fill in. Now, unfortunately, where most of the issues with today that deal with phosphorus input to Lake Erie is in that western basin, that shallow part of the lake. It's really conducive for algal blooms and such. And that area of the lake does fill in a little bit faster because it gets a lot of runoff from the Maumee River, from the Detroit River. It all sort of mixes in that west end. Well, we went ahead and eliminated those point sources back in the 70s. Lake Erie had started to recover. And in fact, my colleagues at Ohio Sea Grant really pushed because an old Dr. Seuss book used to talk about Lake Erie in it. And those types of problems had been somewhat taken care of, and they lobbied Dr. Seuss to remove Lake Erie from it's something like it's smelly up in Lake Erie or something like that. So if that's an indicator of success. Now here we turn around some 30, 40 years later, and the problems that we're seeing in the western part of Lake Erie are due to non-point source pollution. So not from pipes itself, but from more diffuse sources, farm fields and other activities within a watershed. I think one thing that we've done over these 50 years is really started to concentrate on watersheds too, and not just think of the lakes as their own separate receiving water with a few pipes. If you eliminate the pipes, you eliminate the problems. We started to look more into the watersheds and looking at inputs from watersheds has sort of tended to change our focus on where, especially from a nutrient standpoint, where those things are fueling algal growth is coming out of the watershed itself. So now we're looking at a different side of the Clean Water Act that deals with non-point source pollution and what is an acceptable load of nutrients or contaminants and such that are coming from watersheds. So they call this the total maximum daily load. You try to get to, if you want to get quantifiable, you try to get to a certain number where it would have no adverse effects. And so where you see the different types of non-governmental organizations that will sue relative to the Clean Water Act, we see more and more of those associated with non-point source pollution. So we still have to do our work to keep our watersheds and rivers clean for the Great Lakes.
It must be a lot bigger job, though, to track down all those sources of non-point source pollution.
It is. It is. It's a lot more difficult in order to do it. It's difficult to with a pipe. You can always ascribe a certain amount. You know what's coming out the pipe. You know what the concentration is. But now we're talking about other types of nutrients or contaminants that may have fallen from the air, that were added as fertilizer, that are more diffuse in the way that they enter the lake. And it's that challenge to try to eliminate sources or at least cut down on sources in watersheds that much research is going on now.
For a place, let's say, like Lake Erie, or pick your lake from among the Great Lakes, how much of a buffer would it take to protect the lake from those non-point sources?
That's a great question, and that's a research question right now. When we talk about how to build buffering capacity within a watershed, how to maybe redirect flow off of farm fields into a settling basin or into something that you might be able to treat, or do we put in large buffer strip areas around sensitive waters? That's a challenge. It'll be a challenge too for issues for issues associated with climate change. On do we have shaded rivers for trout? Do we have all of these issues there? These large issues that still will take a lot of research to solve or to get closer.
But in large measure, again, just since we've started with Lake Erie, it's healthier than it was in the 70s.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that there are parts of Lake Erie that are healthier than they were back in the 70s. That western basin of Lake Erie is where there continue to be problems. The phosphorus issue has sort of reared its head again. And if you remember back about, was it 8 to 10 years ago with Toledo, when they had to shut down their drinking water. And this is a huge area of research now in harmful algal blooms. Many of them are blue-green algae that secrete toxins. There are a lot of blooms in western Lake Erie now of potentially hazardous blooms of algae. They're overwhelmed with phosphorus inputs from in the western area. So that, if you look at the 2022 State of the Lake report that the International Joint Commission puts out, you'll see that Lake Erie or part of Lake Erie, the western basin of Lake Erie, is still not improving or deteriorating, whereas many of the other Great Lakes with respect to nutrients may be good or slightly better, but there are certain areas of certain lakes that are problems.
Those algae blooms, they're keyed by phosphorus primarily?
Mostly by phosphorus, some by nitrogen. If you were to look here in Wisconsin, an area that we keep pretty – or the research community keeps great watch on is in Green Bay. We've remediated for contaminants, but again, it's that watershed picture. So there are some harmful algal blooms that occur regularly in Green Bay. The difference between Green Bay and Toledo is that Toledo got their drinking water directly out of Lake Erie. Green Bay gets Lake Michigan drinking water, but it comes from the other side of the Door Peninsula, or comes from the Manitowoc-Kewaunee area, and that's where their source of drinking water is, not that it's right in Green Bay.
You would think that whatever the obstacles, whether it's a large agricultural lobby or something like that, that when it starts affecting people's drinking water, that then there would be some considerable pushback.
Yes. And even here in Wisconsin, we see that. We see that where just from agricultural issues that might be in conflict with private drinking water wells, that it's what occurs in the landscape is starting to affect our drinking waters. It's also affecting the nearshore areas of the Great Lakes.
Let's look at some of the specific contaminants and their status in the Great Lakes today when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Jim Hurley. He's the director of the UW Aquatic Sciences Center, and we're looking into the Great Lakes and their state, better or worse than they were in the 1970s in particular, and who are some of the players and what are some of the contaminants that we hear about. There's an old joke about mercury in the fish in the Great Lakes, and you just, if you want to eat it, you just wait for a cold day, you hang the fish upside down, all the mercury goes to the head, and you eat the rest. You know, kind of gallows humor in a way, Jim, but I gather mercury is still very much a problem.
Yeah, and that's I don't advise that particular method for reducing mercury in fish flesh, and it's mainly because the form of mercury that accumulates in fish, the bioaccumulative methyl mercury, actually is more partitions better to the to the protein, to the fish meat itself. So it's difficult to remove that from it. Now, there are other fish advisories that have been out for things like PCBs, where they tell you how you can lower the amount of PCBs in a fish by getting rid of the fat, and that's one possible way. But unfortunately, for mercury, it partitions to the protein and in the meat itself. Yeah.
And where has this mercury been coming from? Has it been stopped from putting new mercury into the lakes? And this is just mercury that's been circulating around ever since? Or what's its status?
Yeah, it's a little bit different from issues like PCBs and such, where it was more of a point source pollution that was cleaned up. The problem with mercury is that in its if we get down into the chemistry of mercury, mercury, it loves to form a vapor. It doesn't like to stay in its in the metallic form that it's in. If you think back of mercury, it has the chemical symbol Hg, which stands for hydro argentum or quicksilver, and it had these properties back in centuries ago that people thought were miraculous, that it could be used for treatment, it could be used for medicines. We use mercury in vaccines up to a certain point because it adding mercury doesn't allow microbes to grow and such. So mercury has all of these different properties, and the one that makes it more difficult to control is the fact that it forms a vapor phase. If you had a bead of mercury on a table, and you remember as a kid, we actually did have mercury in our house, and you would press on it and turn it into tiny little balls. Well, that mercury is probably going to form a vapor and go up into the air. So by doing that, that allows mercury to travel at great distances too. So if we look at the more recent inputs of mercury to the global ecosphere, the two largest sources of mercury are coal-fired power plants, and then another one that's really important is what they call artisanal gold mining. And artisanal is small scale. It happens mainly in developing countries that don't have the technologies to use other methods for gold, for finding gold.
Gold would somehow bond to the mercury?
Yeah, and that's one of those great properties of mercury that that it's it forms an amalgam with gold and silver. Your fillings that you get in your teeth are an amalgamation of mercury and silver. But gold and mercury too is pretty important because it too forms an amalgam. And what happens in small-scale gold mining areas around the world, or artisanal gold mining, is that mercury is used to collect the gold. So if you think about the way that the miners out in California when the gold rush came, all of those sluices that they used to use, those were all lined with mercury. And so as the water came across and the fine fluvial gold deposits that were in the sides of the hills there, that's how they concentrated the mercury, or that's how they concentrated the gold, was with mercury. So there's that legacy of mercury pollution, say, in San Francisco Bay that dates back to that
time. It
is
there from
the
1850s.
From that time, yeah, that it still cycles within that watershed. Now, when you talk about some of these smaller scale gold mining areas, they will form that amalgam, and then they'll burn off the mercury, basically vaporize the mercury, and then you're left with pure gold.
Is that good news?
That
to
is
burn it
not,
off?
Not good, news, good news, especially if you're working in close proximity.
You're breathing
to
it in.
And you're breathing it in. Yeah, and so that still remains a real problem. It's basically the same, in a sense, the same technology that was used, 160 years ago or so.
And is it still legal, this use of mercury for gold mining in the Great Lakes area?
No, you can't use that. There are other cyanide is another way of doing it. So there are costs and benefits of each. But yes, there was a global movement to eliminate the use of mercury in these types of instances, and it's known as the Minamata Convention. Minamata was a city in Japan that suffered from a great deal of contamination of mercury that was discharged into a nearshore area, and much of our toxicological research that we use today is based on some of the studies that were done back in the 60s and 50s and 60s in Minamata.
So the mercury that is still a problem in the Great Lakes is from what time period?
So probably most of the mercury that we see in the Great Lakes and the problems that we have, it's most likely recent deposition, that we still have a signal of mercury in fish. There are a lot of other factors that go in, and which I'll get back to in a second. But what we've done is you can see a drop in mercury concentrations in fish that have been collected just about every year in the Great Lakes back from the 70s up until now. You can see that there's been a shift in the amount of mercury that ends up in the fish because of point sources being eliminated. So the point sources have been eliminated, but in the background, there's been mercury that comes into the Great Lakes through atmospheric inputs. That has decreased.
That has decreased too.
It too is increasing. If you think about the fact that so many of the power plants in the Great Lakes region have switched from coal to natural gas, that's made a big difference. There have been rules that have come down from EPA on smokestack emissions, the same types of rules that helped eliminate or mitigate the acid rain problem also helped us in eliminating some of the mercury inputs locally. But there are still a lot of coal-fired plants out there, and there's still a lot of artisanal gold mining, and the fact that mercury is volatile and that it can travel great distances, that's probably what you're seeing as the mercury that still accumulates. There are still advisories for mercury in fish in the region, and most of that is because of atmospheric inputs.
If the level of mercury is going down in the Great Lakes fish and in the air of the Great Lakes, where is it going? Because, I mean, can mercury be created or destroyed?
It can't be created or destroyed unless you're talking about isotopes and radioactivity. But that's another issue. No, what we're seeing is that mercury continues to accumulate in the bottom sediments of the lake.
So the fish die and it
or the algae, that not all of it gets taken up, that it first has to accumulate in the phytoplankton, then to the zooplankton and to the small fish, to the large fish. So the food web plays such an important role in determining what the concentration of mercury is in that fish.
Is it just going to all end up in the bottom of the lake then ultimately?
That's probably the repository for most of it. But we're still getting that background. There'll still be background coming in atmospherically. There are some natural sources of mercury too. The volcanoes and such haven't been too much of a problem
in the Great Lakes. But as you say, if it gets into the air from, you know, some latter-day Mount Pinatubo, then that would be a source, wouldn't it?
And one of the issues that we're facing right now, when you think about all of the wildfires that have been occurring in Canada and such over the summer, well, mercury partitions pretty strongly to organic matter like the soils and such. If you burn those off, now you've got another source of volatile mercury back into the atmosphere. So elimination, I'd say in quotes, but we could see decreases, but there are many other factors that affect how much you bioaccumulate in fish.
Are there fish that you would eat out of the Great Lakes?
I would follow the recommendations of the Departments of Natural Resources, of Health. This state does a great job of creating materials that inform the public about what is acceptable in the number of meals and the number of certain types of fish. So where you really want to, if you're looking at those advisories, you've got to think about the size of the fish, the age of the fish, how much is accumulating.
How much time has had to actually accumulate mercury.
Correct. And as I said, the food web plays a very important part in determining the final concentration in a fish fillet, say. And that's where we've had some great changes in the Great Lakes over time.
What sort of changes in terms of edibility of
the
fish?
The thing in a recent study that was associated with our group on the Madison campus here, and also the USGS lab here in Madison, looking at that archived data from the Great Lakes, the EPA Great Lakes had since the 1970s. They've got a great fish collection, and you can look at concentrations over 50, 60 years almost so you can go back in and subsample them. In Lake Michigan, you could clearly see that in the early 70s that we got a drop in concentration into the 80s or so. But since then, the concentrations in the fish have been fairly level, that they haven't continued to drop despite seeing the better air quality, the better water quality and such. At the same time, we've had massive changes in the food web over time, that Lake Michigan isn't as productive in the open waters as it used to be. There isn't as much phytoplankton. Invasive species have actually had an effect by sort of flattening out that curve, and it's a fascinating story. You wouldn't think that would happen if you eliminate all of these different sources. You expect to see things change right away, but when you've got other factors like the food web changes coming on, that makes it a little more difficult.
Let's look at some of those biological challenges, invasive species, and how they are affecting the Great Lakes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Jim Hurley. He is the director of the UW Aquatic Sciences Center, which includes the Sea Grant Institute and also the Water Resources Institute at the UW. And we have been looking at the state of the Great Lakes from particularly the 1970s until now. And so far we've looked mostly at mercury as a contaminant and its progress and in some cases lack thereof. And let's look at some of the other things. Well, I mentioned also the invasive species. We'll get to that too. But before we do read from time to time, Jim, about plastics, microplastics and PFAS and PCBs. And we've also been talking about point source pollution. Are those sources of pollution things that we can pinpoint?
Ooh, that's a good question because there are so many different compounds that you talked about. The microplastics issue is I guess you would probably classify that as more of a non-point source, that there isn't a direct discharge of microplastics or of plastics. But it's really gotten us to rethink what is the fate of the types of things that we are more commonly used to using, and what is the fate of that in something as confined as the Great Lakes. We see the plastics issue and the microplastics issue out in the oceans. We tend to think of those giant floating patches.
Yeah, the garbage patch
the
in
garbage
the Pacific.
Patch and the gyres that form it. But if you look a little bit more closely at the Great Lakes, I mean, if you were to look at the beaches on our Great Lakes, they're starting to accumulate within the sand. We're starting to see fine plastics. That it is a problem that we're currently trying to understand through research that's supported under marine debris funding and things like this from the federal government. What's difficult about microplastics are that it's not easy to predict their fate because there are so many different types of plastics. There are so many different sizes of plastics. And with the technologies that we have, with the instrumentation we have, if you look close enough, you're probably going to find them. You'll talk microplastics, but there's a lot of research now going on into nanoplastics, so the next size down. And some of the biggest issues related to microplastics, yes, they're ubiquitous. We can see them just about anywhere. But we also have to try to figure out are there other contaminants that are associated with the microplastics? And then you throw on top of that all of these different types of plastics too. It makes it very difficult to try to assess the fate of microplastics. We see them in so many places. We see them in fish. We're starting to see them in smaller zooplankton. But we've got to try to figure out what secondary effects that they have too. That, you know, it's not just the large plastic rings and that form on, you know, the wildlife get caught on. They're those smaller plastics that we're just learning more and more about.
Are we finding them in people?
We're finding them in people too. Where you look and with the right tools, you can probably find them. Now, when I say that, it could be a single fiber, it could be a single strand, it could be a small microbead. But it's a real challenge to try to figure out the fate of microplastics because they are so different. There are so many sizes. They may tend to accumulate contaminants that have similar chemical properties that they have. They may be coated with what we call biofilms that are a conglomeration of a bunch of different types of microbes. Are they contaminated? Are they bioaccumulating? It's an area rich with research studies right now.
What harm do they do?
It depends. On a macroplastics, yeah, you can probably see that they are that the larger some larger pieces may be disrupting zooplankton or larger fish that they may be on the gills, they may be disrupting flow of oxygen, those types of things. But I think the big question is as they get smaller and smaller, their surface areas become bigger and bigger. They may also or accumulate other types of contaminants. Then not only do you have to study the microplastic, you have to study the contaminant that's associated with the microplastic.
So if we have a beach on Madeleine Island, let's say, it's going to have microplastics in it?
If you look close enough, you'll probably find microplastics, nanoplastics, sure. And it's not like the beach is coated with plastic in any way, but it's much like you find glass, you find other types of things in plastics. It's from not only from use on that site and say the degradation of the plastics that you're using on the beach, but it's also plastics that may have washed in, that may have blown in, and that just makes it such a difficult area of research.
Any thought about how to actually get rid of it? I mean,
eliminate it at the source.
Eliminate it at the source. You would still have what's already out there, but
right. Right. That's what I think that and others feel too is that if we just keep eliminating the sources, that's the real way to attack the microplastics issue.
So at least we don't get any more.
You're right. You can. There are ways to. There's some real innovative tools that beach managers use that basically clean their beaches or rake the sands and separate out the plastics.
Really,
and remove
they can
it
do
from that.
Yeah. Even with micro or nanoplastics.
Not so much with the nanos,
but micro?
Some with the micros, but mainly just getting rid of those larger pieces before they come microplastics.
How do you get rid of those things? What do you do with them?
That's right.
it's somebody else's problem.
That's right. We talk about sediments that are contaminated. And you're remediating a river, you still have to put contaminants somewhere else too. And so that's the challenges of environmental science.
What are the sources of those microplastics some of the sources that we can identify?
Oh, the types of products that we use, the plastic wraps, the plastic bags, the shopping bags. There are many cities around the Great Lakes that have either put a tax on plastic bags when you shop or have eliminated them totally. It's that education of telling people or trying to get people to cut down on their use so that they can see a connection between a plastic bag that you might get at a store and a fish in the Great Lakes. And that's some of the challenges. That's the outreach that needs to accompany research, that we really need to have that Wisconsin idea type of outreach throughout the region. That's probably one of the highlights of our Sea Grant program, that we have that outreach to translate the result, to try to tell people what the best science is, and then have them make decisions based on what they know.
In the meantime, there are these other environmental threats. I think it's safe to call zebra mussels and I guess their successors, quagga mussels, that we mentioned at the beginning as threats to the ecology of the Great Lakes.
And that's right. And that sort of ties back to the question that when we were talking about mercury and fish and why aren't we seeing such continual lowering of the concentration. If you look at the history of invasive species in the Great Lakes, things like the lamprey, the sea lamprey coming in once the canals opened.
The
Welland Canal and even the Erie Canal when it came through. And that was sort of our marquee invasive species. It's one that you can show. It's one that you can that you can easily show on the side of a fish, you know, that's our side of lake trout, and almost eliminated the lake trout, the natural lake trout population in the Great Lakes. And we continue to treat for sea lamprey and key streams around around the Great Lakes. And that's that was the, I guess you'd call it, the earlier days of invasive species. But the quagga, the zebra mussel, came in first, and that populated probably some of the hard, more of the hard surfaces around the Great Lakes. You'd see them on rocks, or you'd see them on some really compacted sands. When its cousin, the quagga mussel, was introduced to the Great Lakes, that's where some even greater changes occurred, because quagga mussels don't necessarily need hard surfaces. They can attach to soft surfaces. They
like
can
a shipwreck.
Attach deep to shipwrecks. Absolutely, and that's been a major problem there. If you take something like Lake Michigan, there was an estimate done maybe about 5 years ago that said that I think it tried to quantify the number of quagga mussels in Lake Michigan. They are everywhere, as Temer's quote had said. You know, if you drained it, it would be a bowl of quagga mussels. It's because they cover the entire bottom of Lake Michigan and just about any type of surface. And the calculation that someone made about 5 years ago was that if Lake Michigan were fully mixed, the quagga mussels could filter all of the water in Lake Michigan in 10 to 14 days. And that's astounding
it
when
is.
You think about
just in the last, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, probably 15 to 20 years on the quaggas, because they've actually quickly formed out into the deeper waters, more so in, I'd say, like in the last 10 years or
so. And they came from where?
Ponto Caspian area. Most of the invasive species we see, they come from basically they're brought into the Great Lakes, or they have been brought
the
in
holds.
through ballast water and ships. If a ship comes, that's one of the interesting sides of commerce on the Great Lakes is that it's not just shipping within the Great Lakes, that there are international ships that come in. And if they have ballast water to make the trips, and they drain that ballast water, if they drain that in the Great Lakes, they're bringing whatever came from the waters that they filled it up on. So,
is that still legal?
No, there are major efforts. And I think they're starting to see some success in the number of invasive species that have been introduced to the Great Lakes, that it might be starting to level off because of what they call, is it NOBOB or NABOB, no ballast on board, that when a ship comes in into the Great Lakes, it has to exchange its salt water ballast, or wherever its origin was, and replace it with cleaner Great Lakes water. It should be treated, we're starting to see some progress, I think, but it's taken a number of years to get to that point.
Makes you wonder what the Caspian, where they came from, must be like. I'm surprised it hasn't filled in entirely.
And those are the areas that you try to use to predict what the changes might be in the Great Lakes based on what they're seeing. So the lower Great Lakes have a lot of quagga mussels in them. Lake Superior doesn't have a quagga mussel population really established in Lake Superior yet. There's some theories about whether it has enough calcium or whether it's right for the formation of shells, but we haven't seen it in Lake Superior, and it's had a huge effect on Lake Michigan, particularly. Since it's covered the most of the bottom of Lake Michigan, you don't really see the effects of non-point source nutrient additions to the lake, because the quagga mussels are pretty efficient in taking up the small algae that start to grow. I remember giving a talk about 5 years ago to a university alumni group, and they saw that I was an environmental chemist, and they started out the talk and they thanked me for the clearer water in Lake Michigan because of people like me.
And I hated to tell them. You happen to be a quagga mussel.
it was quagga mussels that have been doing it. And that has some huge changes on the food web in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron and the lower lakes because of their ability to filter vast amounts of water. And when they came into the area, they just spread as quickly as can be.
Do they have an Achilles heel?
That's the $6 million question or many more million than that. Is there something that can feed on them? And we're starting to see that another invasive species, the round goby, starting to find that round goby have quagga mussel shells.
Asian carp?
No, those are the Asian carp. That's another battle fighting off on the southern part of the Great Lakes, the Chicago Ship Canal and up that way. But the round gobies are fairly small, and they're starting to see that they have been feeding on the quagga mussels. We're starting to see actually there's some evidence that even some of the larger species may be feeding directly on quagga mussels. But to crop it down to size, I don't think – some say that it may just take some sort of disease or some sort of limiting factor to eliminate them. But they've had a vast problem on our fisheries, on all the way up the food web.
Well, I suppose, yes, a kind of a Malthusian solution where they just eat all of their food supply and
that's right.
Go belly up. I guess good news, bad news.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Is the goby, is that native or that's
no,
an invasive
that too
also?
Is an invasive species that may, you know, that if there's an intermediary in there that can feed or establish themselves on quagga mussels, maybe we might have a chance.
We've seen some scary results, though, from bringing in predators in other places.
That's true.
It's been a real disaster in Australia, I think, for example.
That's the balance that you always have to play. It's a delicate ecosystem, and tweaking it in one spot can have some major effects on others.
What's the effect or the cause, I guess, of – we hear about it more and more now – the fluctuating water levels in the Great Lakes, which I guess wreak kind of havoc too on commerce and fishing and other recreation too.
That is a huge issue. If you look at Lake Michigan specifically, we over a five-year period, we went from a record low to a record high. And over 5 feet of water level change. And as our friends in our Sea Grant programs on the ocean's coast talk about sea level rise, they're talking about millimeter sea level rise. And we have huge fluctuations in the Great Lakes. It can there's only so many factors that will affect the water levels in the Great Lakes. It's the runoff, the tributary inputs. Rainfall and snow melt and all of those outflow, which you know, from if you take something like Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, outflow is through the Detroit River out that direction, and then evaporation. And evaporation it's predicted that had a huge effect on the water levels that came to record lows.
If you have a drought, you mean?
If you have a drought, you're not getting the rainfall for sure. So you've eliminated or you've decreased that part of the input to the lake. But certain types of winters may lead to more evaporation. There's a lot of evaporation that occurs starting about now and through the rainfall period in early March. That's the lake effect snow is an example of that. So that's part of if there's no ice cover and then you get some dry air during the winter, you get a lot of evaporation. So it was a combination of lower inputs due to rainfall and then also for increase in evaporation.
And if you, it sounds as if you're saying also if you have a warmer than usual winter, you don't get the ice cover.
Correct.
And then you get
– There's a lot of research that's going on right now about what they call winter limnology of the Great Lakes, or limnology being the study of inland waters. But studies to understand what really happens during the winter in these lakes, it's not a time where a lot of us go out and do a lot of research on the Great Lakes. And understanding that dynamic that happens in the wintertime, is that where we're losing a lot of lake level? It did come back. I mean, we were at record lows and then we were at record highs. Those record highs followed very, very wet years. And it really does it's a harbinger of what climate change can do. I remember a friend of mine saying that, it's not the means that hurt you, it's the extremes. And that's an example of extremes, from going, 5 feet of lake level change when we're not prepared for something like that. As you said earlier, increased dredging, increased port maintenance, those types of things. So then 5 years later, you're building walls or riprapping along a bluff to keep land from being degraded. So resilience is a huge issue for the Great Lakes, and how resilient we can build our infrastructure to be able to handle those types of changes.
From a shipping standpoint, I don't remember the numbers, but they're surprisingly large, with difference that just a couple of inches of lake level can
Absolutely.
Make in terms of how much cargo you can put in a freighter.
And that has a huge economic impact. Those years from 5-7 years ago, when it was a record low, that's where many of those estimates were taken. Well, actual data, I guess, of just not being able to fill a ship loaded with iron pellets to be shipped further on, that decreasing loads, and then that having a huge economic effect.
It's going to be a lot of sorting out to do, and I gather that places like the Sea Grant Institute and the Water Resources Institute will be well funded to help to determine what's going on and what might be done?
We hope so. I mean, they're such great researchers here in the state of Wisconsin through our university system, our connection to other universities in the Great Lakes. There's plenty to be done, and we've seen funding start to tick up. We'd like to see it rise a little bit faster.
Faster than the Great Lakes sometimes
That's
do.
That's right.
Jim Hurley, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me next time around. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and this is University of the Air.